It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show, Politics Without the Boring Bits. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. Coming up today, we're talking the politics of vegetables. Yeah, there's a big crisis going on, according to a new parliamentary report. There aren't enough people putting vegetables in the ground. There aren't enough people to pull them out of the ground. And as a result, we're all paying more in the shops. So that's coming up in our big thing in just a moment. But first, let's take a look at what's going on in the news with these two.
The Colonists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on Times Radio.
Yeah, it's Monday, so it must be Libby Purvis. Hello, Libby.
Hello.
Hello. And in the studio is Rachel Sylvester. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Matt.
Now, obviously, we're all very excited. We're digging out our ermine, ready for the King's Speech on Tuesday. Rishi Sunak, it's always one of these things where I always think if it's not a clever trap you're laying for the opposition, if you go around telling everyone, we've laid a clever trap, you know, it's all a bit obvious. And the latest clever trap is announcing annual licensing rounds for North Sea oil and gas exploration. The idea being that then the Labour Party would have to say whether or not they'd keep them and whether or not that's in keeping with their plans for net zero and therefore forces some sort of dividing line between the Tories and the Labour Party. I have to confess, Rachel, I find this one a bit complicated.
I think it's a bit too clever by half, isn't it? Yeah. And also slightly depressing that this is your last shot potentially to set the legislative agenda for a parliament, and you're thinking about politics and petty partisan point scoring rather than actually what do you really want to do with your gut time in government. And on terms of this net zero sort of trap they're supposedly setting for the Labour Party, the complicated thing about this policy is it doesn't seem to be reducing energy prices in any way. It's a sort of, to most people, it'll look like quite a technical thing. And actually, in any case, the voters are quite ambiguous about Rishi Sunak's, at best, about Rishi Sunak's promise to back away from the net zero pledges. So if you're trying to send a, what you can do if you're the government is you can send a message about your values through the King's Speech. So, you know, what they're saying is we're backing away from net zero. And then the other thing that seems completely bonkers from my point of view is this Suella Braverman thing declaring that homelessness is a lifestyle choice and sort of banning tents. What are they saying about their values that is going to appeal to the general electorate?
I mean, I could at least see the politics of the but I don't think actually the solution to the Conservative Party is to move further to the right. But I could see, I mean, at least arguing over tents and homeless people is a clear dividing line which people can take a position on and have an argument about. And that's obviously what Suella Braverman wants, is to have a constant argument about whether or not it's the right thing to say. Libby, I just don't, and I'll be surprised, and obviously we've seen a lot of demonstrations in recent times. I'd like to see how big the march will be, shouting, what do we want, annual licensing rounds for North Sea oil and gas exploration? When do we want it in the forthcoming King's Speech?
Oh, it's also half-baked, isn't it? I mean, there are various attempts at populism in the crime bill, you know, like, oh, crackdowns on shoplifting and so on, and people having to attend their sentencing hearing. But then nothing about improving the terrible backlog in the courts, which is really serious, and the fact that the prisons are full. And then you have the tobacco thing, but absolutely nothing about getting rid of these disastrous disposable multicoloured vapes, which are addicting and damaging children. and are absolutely disastrous for the environment and waste of minerals and so on. It just feels everything's kind of goes about a quarter of the way and then peters out in this speech. Even the leasehold reform thing, which is a good populist idea, but it still apparently doesn't include flats, you know, which is an enormous amount of problem there. So I'm not inspired, you know. I'm not bothering with the ermine this time. I know you sit in yours at, well, you said get the ermine out. I assume you sit in yours at home.
At all times. It's obviously vegan ermine.
Polyester, you mean.
And there were other things which have been promised, which aren't in the, as far as we know, promised King's Speech.
Yeah, the one that I'm most worried about is there was been promised for years now reform of the Mental Health Act, which, following a review by the very distinguished psychiatrist Sir Simon Wesley, who was commissioned by Theresa May actually to do a review of a really outdated piece of legislation about who can be sectioned and how and when, and he came up with a very sensible set of proposals which have cross-party support. They've been through multiple stages of legislation. The only thing remaining is for the government, a government, to find time to make them law. They're not controversial, really. And from what we hear, they're not going to be in the King's Speech. And at the same time, there's a story in the paper today about thousands of autistic people being held in mental health facilities completely inappropriately, which is one of the things that this the Wesley Act would sort out. So I think, you know, it's back to the question of values. The one thing you can do is signal what you believe in. And this was one of Theresa May's burning injustices, but clearly not for Rishi Sunak.
The other thing I find odd about it, Libby, is the tail end of a government, ahead of a general election, just putting in some things which are uncontroversial and will force the sort of people who normally complain about you to say, actually, this is a good thing. And that might chew up some time in the endless analysis post King's Speech. It strikes me as sort of bad politics as well as, you know, arguably bad policy.
Well, it would be lovely, wouldn't it, to think that somebody who reckons that really, especially after these latest accusations about the Conservative Party MPs, a government which is clearly on the way out is not going to win the next election. It might win the one after, but not going to win the next election. So go out in a great blaze of smoke and fire and fireworks, you know, and say, actually, we're going to do this and this and this, and within the next year we're going to get this going and this going. If a bit of positivity would be at least good to see, you know, even though the Labour Party could then sort of abandon all of it, you know, and say when it gets back into power. But it just feels, it feels so damp and wet and depressing, and it's not a good look for autumn, really.
Damp and wet and depressing. Well, we'll see. We'll find out. It's 11:30 Tuesday morning. The King will read out this list of bills.
It's also fascinating to think about what he thinks. So, you know, he said a lot about the environment and the importance of net zero. His son is mounting a campaign on homelessness. So actually, I remember this with the Queen sometimes, you know, you'd hear her saying extraordinary things from a Labour government. Yeah. What's the King thinking as he reads out these words tomorrow?
Yeah, and I suppose unlike the late Queen, we know far more about what Charles thinks about things because he's told us over the years. My favourite of all the Queens, the late Queen's reading out, was when she announced a levy on plastic bags, as if she's never, ever picked up a plastic bag in Asda before. Let's move on, because this is an interesting, and this is something we've talked a lot about before, about school absences and how kids aren't going to school post-pandemic. It's Sir Peter Lamport, who's the founder of the Sutton Trust, said that school closures during lockdown led to a breakdown of the social contract. So basically, parents are quite happy now to turn... Some parents, not all, but some parents are happy to sort of turn a blind eye now. They're working from home anyway, so it's sort of easier to let the kids stay at home. 140,000 pupils severely absent in the spring term of this year in England, according to the Department for Education. One child in five missed at least one day a fortnight because it's just the habit has been broken. And I suppose, Libby, thinking about all the hullabaloo about what Dominic Cummings did or didn't say in a WhatsApp message last week, this is a part of the fallout of lockdown that just doesn't really seem to be being analysed by this inquiry.
It's huge. I mean, we know, Anne Longfield has said, Children's Commission owner, that children were simply not thought about. You know, nobody thought about education. Nobody, you know, it was just shrugged off in the panic over the pandemic and in the lockdown and the closing of schools, which a lot of people sort of had predicted would be a very bad thing, has proven to be a very bad thing, and the end of this sort of sense that getting children to school really is important. I think now there has to be, as the Sutton Trust says, a lot of rowback on the old austerity, which affected all the school home support offices and services like that and truant officers. You know, it's just not happening enough now. And for a lot of children, this will be a disaster. And I think the linking it to working from home is, there's probably quite a lot of truth in that, but it's not the only thing. I think a kind of contract was broken, and people, and then the teacher strikes, to be honest, that hasn't helped either, the sense of children being sent
That's
home
true.
when they didn't have to be after the pandemic. I think, you know, it has to be taken very firmly in hand. And again, I noticed nothing in the King's speech about this.
Well, I know you've looked at this a lot, Rachel, through the Times Education Commission.
Yeah, I think Libby's absolutely right. I agree with everything she said. And I think there's a problem that it's not just parents who are to blame. I think you do have to blame the government, because children were such a low priority. It wasn't important for children to go out to school for the government. So therefore, now the pandemic's over, families think, well, why should we force the issue? There's also, I think, a lot, it's also related from what we heard on the Education Commission, to mental health problems often. So children who feel now unable to go back to school for mental health reasons. And Anne Longfield, we spoke to on the Health Commission last week, actually, and she talked about how children are now having to prove that they have attempted suicide multiple times in order to get mental health support. So that's back to, you know, something that the government could do, actually, but isn't.
I suppose once a social contract is broken, Libby, what can you do to restore that?
It's really difficult, isn't it? I mean, we're seeing this also about disorder in the streets and, you know, sort of chaos and, you know, the public realm. It's very hard to row back from it and sort of go all Singapore. You know, it's a difficult thing. But I think schools have to be made into something that kids want to go to and that parents want to have their kids at, you know, improvement in schools and, you know, smaller classes and all the massive improvements in education which we need, and more enrichment and less focus on sort of desperate box-ticking exam and curriculum requirements. All these things just need attention. Things need to be made attractive. But I think the breaking of the social contract, that feeling that it's disgraceful for your children not to be at school, I think that's a much harder thing to crawl back from.
But also, I think it's making clear that education is a priority for society and for the government and for families, and that it really, really matters. And somehow education has slipped down the list of priorities in Whitehall. So you look at the funding of health has gone up 42% since 2010, and education's gone up 3%. So effectively, it's being cut.
Is that in real terms?
In real terms. Yeah, yeah. So you look at the difference in priorities, you can see what the government cares about. So no wonder parents and children are thinking, well, education isn't really important, when it is the fundamental thing. You have to explain why it's so important.
And somebody, I think it was Camilla Long's piece of the weekend, pointing out the amount that we spent on Eat Out to Help Out and Test and Trace and all of that, and yet they rejected, and Rishi Sunak may well be asked this when he appears at the inquiry, he rejected that £15 billion catch-up fund, to the point that Kevin Collins, who was the catch-up czar, resigned over it.
Yeah.
And you think, well, actually, if you'd found that money, they can find money quite, you know, they do magic up money around the place. In fact, there's a £15 billion they've just
found
now. Found
through tax.
If they came out and said, we are going to spend this on catching up the nation's kids, as Kevin Collins suggested.
Yeah.
That's a sort of big, bold idea, but rather than an annual licensing round for North Sea
exactly.
oil and gas.
Plus also making the education more relevant and, you know, appealing to children and employers, as set out in the Times Education Commission.
Yeah, absolutely. Quite right too. Get the plug in. Quite right too. And I suppose, never mind, you know, we talk about the strikes and the lockdown. The fact the schools are falling down and schools have had to shut or, you know, doing homeworking and all of that, that suddenly, you know, there's a constant stream of things coming along which basically say, actually, you don't need to come into school.
Yeah, or it might be quite dangerous because the concrete might fall on your head.
Might come down on your head.
It sort of feels as if we need a new deal, doesn't it? You know, a sort of a big, brave, massive, splashing new deal. You know, let's concentrate entirely on schools and education, on the young for a while.
Education, 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 as Blair said.
As somebody once said. Yeah, absolutely. Lovely stuff. Right, let's turn our attention now to what happens when you get all excited for a night out. You've got your tickets. You've been looking forward to it for ages. And it doesn't quite live up to billing. Would you like to spend an evening with this man?
How should we then envision the future so that we're all maximally motivated, unafraid, unashamed, even confident and enthusiastic? I'm going to puzzle that through, hopefully along with you.
Jordan Peterson, the philosopher, at the O2 last week. James Marriott, Times columnist, regular panelist on the show as well. He was there watching it so that you didn't have to.
Yeah, I was. It was a very weird evening, I have to say.
I was quite surprised but seeing the adverts on the Tube. I mean, like a philosopher selling out the O2.
Yeah,
was it sold out?
Almost, not quite. There are some empty seats. As soon as I saw this advertised, a few months ago now, I was like, this is absolutely fascinating. What on earth is going on? Who's going to turn up to see Jordan Peterson at the O2? Will it be sold out? Does it work? A guy giving a talk to a 20,000-seat arena? What's he going to say? And it was, duly about... Well, actually, I think more weird than I expected. It was a really odd event.
But what I found so fascinating is you said 40% of the people there were women.
Yes.
Well, this is a kind of misogynistic mumbo-jumbo, extraordinary to me that so many women would go. And they had no women on the platform whatsoever, as far as I can work
out. It was really interesting. And
was it just him?
No, so he did a kind of introductory talk. Then there was a panel which he chaired, which was absolutely terrible because all he could do was talk himself.
And the whole panel were men.
Yeah.
So it was him. Okay. Who was it? It was him, Douglas Murray, Bjorn Lomborg, this kind of climate skeptic, and Jonathan Peugeot, I think his name is pronounced, who is a carver of Russian Orthodox icons and a YouTube celebrity. And the whole vibe was very weird. It was interesting because it certainly sort of, I don't know, in a slightly disturbing way, kind of disrupted some of my prejudices, because I think the stereotype people have about Jordan Peterson is that it's all for, you know, there's a kind of negative stereotype that it's all for like incels and weird, kind of isolated, slightly dangerous young men. And the thing that really struck me about the crowd was how kind of normie in internet slang it was, like a lot of very normal people. And yeah, how female. I was asking everyone, what do you reckon the kind of gender ratio is here? And the standard guess was sort of 60-40. And I think he's got so many aspects to him. There's the kind of political anti-woke stuff. There's the kind of put your shoulders up straight and get your life together lifestyle stuff. So I think people are probably there for different reasons. And, you know, everyone's getting something slightly different out of him.
Libby, you must, in your time of theatre reviewing, gone all excited about going to see something and then been bitterly disappointed.
Well, the thing is, there are sometimes disappointments, but the point about being a critic or indeed a journalist like James Marriott is if you've got a notebook on your lap, you know, you're always excited by the intellectual exercise of working out why this thing is so bad, you know, so that even a bad play can actually be quite exciting. But what I liked about this, I loved James's suggestion that there's a very thin line between Jordan Peterson and Gwyneth Paltrow in this business of, you know, change your life, change your life and be different. Because it's all a bit Billy Graham-ish, and in my experience, it's very rarely, and among that of people I know, it's very rarely a sort of Billy Graham-ish extreme sermon which changes people's minds. It's often one small line privately found in a book or heard in a speech or the example of someone who seems to you to have their life and ethics sorted and you'd rather be more like them. The fires of big sort of public event excitement burn out very quickly, but real lives get changed by all sorts of small things, which, you know, maybe people don't even mention because they don't want to be boring evangelists themselves. So I don't think these things ever work, but I'm sure it was interesting. And I mean, James writes wonderfully about it, I have to say, though he had more fun in Paris the other week.
I suppose, James, there's an interesting thing about the rise of spoken word events, ideas-based, you know, whether it's old centrist dads, Alistair Campbell and Maurice Stewart, you know, selling out the Royal Albert Hall or Jordan Peterson at the O2. Maybe it is the podcastization of
Absolutely.
People.
And this is something that I think I was kind of chiding myself when I turned up to this for how, if you work in a newspaper, you can still stay in that mindset that it's all about people writing columns and articles and stuff. When, you know, one hopes that columnists are the centre of the world, but it's not true at all. You know, talking to everybody in the crowd, who did they like? There's a whole universe of, I guess, these kind of strange alt-right celebrities, people like Peterson, people like Ben Shapiro. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, they're not reading, you know, newspapers at all in the traditional way we'd once have thought. It's this, that might be in the background. In the foreground is this other universe of YouTube celebrities. And to be honest, I think saying some fairly dodgy stuff that should concern us, because, you know, this isn't fact-checked and it's not, you know, it's not really mainstream in our old-fashioned sense of that word. It's some really weird stuff. I think quite normal people are now able to access pretty easily and without thinking much about it.
And I suppose, just finally, Rachel, that's this weird thing is that you can have someone selling out the O2 and yet you could stand outside the O2 and ask people, do you know who Jordan Peterson is? And passes, you know, people are either really into him, I have no idea who he is. It's not like Anton Deck or Michael McIntyre, who everyone is sort of heard of.
Yeah, there's a kind of cult following, like James says, and it's actually quite frightening. That these people with really quite extreme ideas can become these huge figures.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. Well, I look forward to you selling out the O2 soon, James.
One day.
Your columns, just reading out your columns about being a young
He wouldn't come. Everyone would come.
James Marriott there and Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. You can read them all in The Times. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's the politics of vegetables.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast now. It's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
I will have a steak.
How'd you like it?
Oh, raw, please.
And what about the vegetables?
Oh, they'll have the same as me.
There's something magic
when you grow your own beans, you grow your own potatoes, you grow your own corn, take it home.
A lot of people would be eating turnips right now rather than thinking necessarily about aspects of lettuce.
The former Prime Minister, who herself got bitten by a lettuce.
Tony Abbott has talked about why he bit into a raw onion.
I normally have them cooked on the barbecue, but I enjoy onion.
The peas are good tonight, dear.
Mmm, they are good.
Your favourite vegetable.
And that's without mentioning the flying tomato.
There we are. You might think that vegetables and politics are like peas in a pod. But it turns out Britain's horticultural sector is a bit of a pickle. So there we heard, that was Margaret Thatcher, obviously, not really from Spitting Image. There was Jeremy Corbyn, Keir Starmer, Therese Coffey, Tony Abbott eating an onion like an apple. John Major eating peas on Spitting Image, and Angela Rayner talking about Dominic Raab allegedly throwing tomatoes, although might tell her that he didn't actually do that. So we're going to talk about the politics of vegetables right now. There's a lack of seasonal migrant workers, which means crops are going unharvested. That's only a hot potato. And it's and the relationship between supermarkets and farmers is all stick and no carrot. Well, today, a House of Lords committee is calling on the government to hold an olive branch to the horticulturalist. Well, Lord Reesdale, who chairs the committee, spills the beans. I asked him what surprised him most when he was looking into the vegetable industry.
It's just the size of the industry more than anything else. Because if you take horticulture, which is, it is fruit and veg, but it's also ornamental plants, it's worth about $5
billion. Wow. That is a, I mean, that's a huge part of the economy. And you're right, maybe does the main message that seems to come from across from the report is it just doesn't get the attention that it deserves. Let's work through some of the stages of the industry. Let's start sort of on the fields, if you like, then. What are the challenges that the growers of fruit and vegetables are facing right now?
I suppose the main challenge if you're growing fruit and veg is the farm gate price you're getting. It's a very low margin. And of course, that's because we're caught up in a cost of living crisis. So the supermarkets want to drive down prices as much as possible. So they're putting the pressure on the growers. But the evidence we took is that for a six apples, the grower is making 3 pence profit.
Wow. And then in terms of staffing, there's clearly been an issue over just finding enough people to work to plant the crops and then to harvest them. How serious? Give us a sense of the severity of that situation and what might be done about it.
So last year, £60 million worth of produce was lost in the fields because there was nobody to pick it. And this is the problem. So we need seasonal workers. And we've had seasonal workers for 50, 60 years, seasonal worker schemes. It's nothing new, but it seems to have been turned into a political football, you know, talking about reducing their numbers, where actually we need probably more. But they don't stay in the country. They just come along, do the job and leave.
I mean, it does seem crackers to me anyway, and possibly to people listening to this conversation, that the politics of we don't want people coming over here literally leads to millions of pounds worth of fruit and vegetables rotting in the field because there's nobody to harvest it at a time where self-sufficiency and actually just having food to put on the shelves when people are struggling to, you know, to pay for their weekly shop. What do you make of that sort of political decision, if you like, to signal so hard that we want to stop people coming here to the point that food's rotting in fields?
It's one of the, I think it's been turned into one of those we want to cut the numbers game because it's an easy one to control in theory. But if you're a farmer and you've got to deal with fruit, picking fruit and veg, you really need to know that you're going to get the workers coming from overseas. And that's just not happening at the moment.
Okay, so that's the situation which sounds pretty tough on the fields. Then take us through the process then of how it gets from the farm to the supermarket. Is there anything in that process which you think could change?
Yeah, we're calling on the government to revisit their review on fairness in the supply chain, because one of the bits of evidence we did take was that, you know, farmers are going to find it very difficult to actually justify planting crops in the first place if they don't know there's going to be a return on investment. And if they don't plant the crops, then we have to get them from overseas, from countries such as Morocco and Spain. And of course, they've got their own problems with climate change due to water issues. So I think what we have to do is say, as a country, we might have to pay a little bit more for food just to make sure that we've got security of supply.
I mean, that's going to be a hard sell at a time when there's a cost of living crisis and people already feel like, you know, even now, despite all the other rises, you know, it's what, about 10, 12% food inflation? You know, it's been double that, I think, earlier in the year. It's a hard sell, that, isn't it, to say you've just got to sort of suck it up for the sake of self-sufficiency. Is there something else that can be done either through regulation or subsidy or something that, so it means that, because everyone has to eat and it takes up such a big proportion of people on the lowest incomes?
I quite agree. You know, going to the supermarket now is just shocking how little you actually get compared to a year ago or 2 years ago. And it is very hard for people, but it's sort of a question of really working with the supermarkets, because they're caught in this sort of competitive spiral to say, we're going to do it the cheapest, and say, as in the continent, well, actually, you have to pay a little bit more. Because here's the problem. If we put our farmers out of business, we're going to end up with the situation that happened with eggs, which is, you know, if you go into the supermarket now, you might only be able to find eggs from Poland or Italy. Over the long term, that costs more.
And that's because so many egg producers in the UK have gone out of business.
Yeah, I mean, you can hardly be a farmer and provide eggs at below the cost of production. A lot of farmers have been hit by the spiraling energy costs. That has to be passed on.
It sounds like this is a pretty crucial moment. You're talking about the energy price, the energy costs have already put egg producers out of business. You've got farmers wondering whether or not to even put fruit and veg in the ground because they don't know if they're going to get the money for it afterwards, which actually will end up meaning more imports, which is both bad for the environment and probably more costly. This feels like a crisis.
It does, but I suppose farmers have been facing this for a very long time. Yeah. But I suppose really there is positive news, which is, you know, the horticultural sector is automating. It's very vibrant. And some people would say it's, you know, world leader in certain elements.
So then what would be your message then to Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, who's, you know, put a lot of her own political capital on being tough on migration? What's your message to her when it comes to making sure there's affordable fruit and veg on our shelves?
Understanding that seasonal workers is not a problem would go forward. It's not something that should be used, just as a throwaway in a press release.
Would you do the job? I assume you've been and sort of looked at these things. Would you do the job of picking fruit and veg?
Well, I've got an orchard myself, and I pick the fruit, and it's not easy. And this is one of the points about seasonal workers, is they're highly skilled.
Yeah.
Going into a field and working for a number of hours, and you're expected to pick vast amounts of fruit, is not easy, and you have to get used to it. Just sending somebody to a field and to pick fruit, they won't be able to provide the amount that the farmer's expecting, and it's really hard work.
You mentioned you've got orchards. Are there lots of horticulturalists in Parliament?
Well, we did have a minister called Lord Gardner who dealt with EPRA, who actually is a farmer. There are quite a few people who deal with this in the House of Lords. I'm not sure there's a great deal of knowledge in the House of Commons.
That may well speak to some of the problems you've been highlighting. Maybe you should have an allotment in Parliament. Then they could everyone can during quiet bits of the day they can, you know, pick some fruit or turn the soil over.
Well, I mean, it'd be excellent if people could actually get onto an allotment, because you could actually grow quite a lot of your own fruit and veg. And my wife is very keen on producing vegetables, but I'm not so keen after she got me to dig the potato patch and I gave myself a hernia.
Lord Reedsdale, Chair of the Horticulture Committee in the House of Lords, which has got a report out today, warning about the state of our fruit and vegetable industry. But Ali Kappa is from the National Farmers Union Horticultural Board, who chairs British Apples and Pears and grows apples and hops in Worcestershire, and joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you, and how is the horticultural sector from your perspective? Does it all ring true what Lord Reedsdale was saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the House of Lords have grasped the issue very well. We do have an impending crisis in fresh produce and, to some extent, plants and flowers as well. So horticulture is all commercial fruit, vegetables, plants and flowers. And what is causing the crisis is the super inflation that all businesses have had in the last couple of years, caused by the war in Ukraine and the energy costs escalating. But for our sector, it's energy and labour costs that have gone through the roof. As an apple grower, 40% of our turnover is labour cost. And that has gone up in the last couple of years by over 20%. So that's a very big number. And then you take energy costs, which are very important. A lot of fruit and vegetables, plants and flowers are either grown using heat and energy, or they're stored using heat and energy. And those energy costs, we haven't had the same as the rest of UK business. Other UK businesses have had discounts, the ETII scheme, the energy trade and intensive industry scheme that the government launched. Don't ask me why, but it excluded our sector. And when a government is trying to bring down food inflation, it needs to concentrate on supporting our sector with energy costs. So I would say Lord Reedsdale and the House of Lords have got it right. I think the solutions, Matt, are really simple. We need a government that wants to champion this sector. It's only 2% of the farmed land area in the UK. It's 25% of the farmed value. And in championing the sector, we need the government to also hold retailers' feet to the fire. The only thing I didn't quite agree with Lord Reedsdale on is actually the consumer is paying more. The consumer is paying more. This isn't about the consumer needing to pay more. The shopper is already paying more. But what's happening is the supermarkets are holding on to that and they're not passing it back down to the farm gate. In Apple, the shopper is paying 17% more, according to the Office for National Statistics. And yet growers are getting a static return. 0.8% was the increase in return that growers had in the last 12 months.
So what's going on there? Is that supermarkets thinking, well, everyone knows there's a cost of living crisis because it's constantly on the news, and energy crisis in Ukraine and so on. So we can put up the price of apples 17% and that's just straight profit.
It's really complex. This map, because supermarkets no longer take the price of a good, put a markup on it and sell it to the consumer. They now talk about a mixed basket of margin. So there's no direct relationship in most retailers' minds to the price that they pay to buy something and the price that they then sell it to the consumer. What we've seen in apples is that price has gone up by 17% to the shopper, and yet growers have only had 0.8% back. So either the retailer is taking more profit or they're subsidizing other loss-making things that they're doing. I don't know what the answer is, but I would say it's not fair.
And it's interesting when we talk about the government, to have a Conservative government traditionally covering rural areas, the party of the countryside, they'd see themselves as closer to the NFU, perhaps in the Labour Party in the past. But this is a recurring theme that is sort of a lack of attention to detail with things like seasonal migrant workers and not having enough people to harvest this stuff, but also just sort of a lack of interest. Is that a fair characterisation of the relationship at the moment between farming and the Conservative government?
Yeah, I'd say it is. I think we've got a government with a cheap food policy that have delegated that cheap food policy to the market. They don't want to get involved. It's too complicated. And a cheap food policy means that if you insist on, which our government does, if you insist on high standards in this country, and those standards are good because they mean safe food, they mean food that doesn't poison people, and they mean food that is of the highest, some of the highest standards in the world. But if you then have a cheap food policy and you delegate it to the market is then left able to import whatever they want from wherever they want, and often to a lower standard. In your last interview, you talked about eggs, the eggs that are available on shelf now from Italy and Poland, many of those are coming from settings which we wouldn't be allowed to farm in that way in this country. And it's the same with fruit and vegetables. fruit and vegetables that are being imported are often being imported with much lower standards than those to which we grow them here in the UK. And I think this is all mad, because with climate change upon us, and as farmers, we are really feeling it. You know, we had 40 degrees last summer. We've had floods and unbelievable winds this autumn. It is happening in the UK, but we are still going to remain, even with the worst forecasts for climate change, the UK will remain a good place to grow food, a place that is able to grow food. And yet many of the countries that we rely on for imports of fruit and vegetables won't be able to grow fruit and vegetables in the future. They'll either be too hot or they won't have enough water. So I would have thought, if you were being strategic about this in government, and you were looking to the long term, you would want to make sure that you were investing in UK fruit and veg, plant and flower production. So not only could we support the consumers in our own country with some of the best fruit and vegetables in the world, but that we can also export to those countries that simply won't be able to grow this stuff in the future.
It's really fascinating that the change, the impact of climate change on this whole debate as well. Ali, really good to speak to you. Ali Capita from the NFU's Horticultural Board. She also grows apples and hops in Worcestershire and chairs British Apples and Pears. Hard to compare. Maybe the answer to all of this is we should be growing our own. Well, I speak to two politicos who know exactly all about doing that. Jane Merrick is policy editor of The Eye and keen allotmateer.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you identify more as an allotment owner than a journalist?
Journalist first, okay. But yeah, my hinterland.
Your hinterland, it's your hinterland. And Flick Drummond is Tory MP for Meon Valley and also a keen grower. Hi, Flick.
Hi, morning.
Flick, what are you growing right now? I know it's not a great time of the year to be asking this question.
Well, you say that I was at my allotment yesterday. I'm trying to grow broad beans, and unfortunately the rain has flooded that bit of the allotment. So they're underwater at the moment. They are still alive, but they are very much flooded.
Oh dear. What about you, Jane? What have you got on the go?
I've got broad beans. My broad beans are actually in a raised bed, so I've avoided the flooding.
Oh, show off.
And I've got, I planted some garlic about 3 weeks ago, and it's come up already. But the thing about garlic is you need like a long period of cold for the bulbs to grow.
So if I was, because I was discussing only yesterday growing garlic, should I be planting it now?
Yes, plant it now while the soil is kind of warmish, and then you'll get a bit of green growth, and then they'll need the cold, about 6 weeks of cold weather to make the bulbs really swell, and then you'll have great garlic next summer.
What do you actually plant? Is it seeds?
You plant cloves. So you have to buy, don't just buy any old garlic from the shop, but buy it from a nursery.
Yeah.
And you separate the bulbs into cloves, and you plant each individual clove, and that one clove becomes a whole bulb. Yeah,
that's amazing. Have you ever grown that, Flick?
Yes, no, I've got that in raised beds. That hasn't been flooded. But I thought I'd do crop rotation, and so the broad beans have gone into a bit which is flooded. Last year they were in a raised bed, so now I know better.
Crop rotation is important, I know this, because you don't want your potatoes going back in the same place and all that. My beetroot's been an absolute triumph this year. We've been pickling it, we've been making soup out of it, we've been roasting it. That's really easy, turns out, beetroot, isn't it?
I found it quite delicious, but hard to grow. Like, I can never really get it big enough. I don't know whether it's because of the soil or...
A lot of muck. Had to dig a lot of muck in.
Yeah.
Carrots looking all right. Flick, do you think... does this report warning about the state of the horticulture, does this sort of ring true with your experience, your constituents and so on?
Yeah, well, particularly the price of food in the shops. That's what obviously we hear about. But it is really concerning, actually, and interesting listening to Ali as well from her perspective. Although I would have thought, because of climate change, our country is going to be one of the best places to grow a lot of fruit and vegetables, and they should start to prepare for that as well, and with the innovation. But the government has put a lot of money into research and innovation on this particular topic, and has given huge amounts of money. So I'm fairly optimistic about the future, although I do understand about the pickers, but I think even that we've begun to address that as well with the seasonal worker visa.
But I suppose part of it is the point who is making, that the enthusiasm of the Home Secretary in particular for appearing very tough. No one should come here, bring up the drawbridge and all that sort of stuff. And actually, it completely flies in the face of, it's madness if £60 million worth of vegetables are rotting in fields.
Yeah, no, I totally agree on that. I don't always see eye to eye with some of her policies on that particular thing. But we've got about 45,000 cap on seasonal workers. And last year there was only 35,000. So there is the capacity to have more seasonal workers coming over. But it's going to be different than it was when we were in the EU. And now we get workers from outside the EU, which is not a bad thing.
Jane, you know of other political fruit and veg growers. There are quite a lot, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. There's obviously Jeremy Corbyn.
Yes, famous.
Has a famous. I think Tracy Crouch has she's talked about her allotment a lot. Quite a few political journalists as well. I mean, it's finding the time. And I mean, I go on a Sunday afternoon is my main thing, and sort of evenings in the summer. But you do have to put the work in to get a return, and you can never really be fully self-sufficient, which is why kind of we could all be growing.
Yeah.
And it takes you can save money on things like tomatoes and soft fruit and salad leaves, but you're still going to need your broccoli, potatoes.
I tried growing broccoli once; it was an absolute disaster.
It's too difficult.
Eaten by moths, not moths, butterflies.
White butterflies. Yeah.
So I thought we'd round off by playing a game of Can you guess the top 10 most popular vegetables? So this is according to YouGov, where they've asked people, do they like this vegetable or not? I've got a scoreboard, so just shout out ones you think. You could go start first, Flip.
Broccoli.
Broccoli is not in the top 10. Jane.
Really?
Potato.
Yes, that's top. 91% are positive about potatoes. Have another. Right, Flip, your go.
Carrots.
Yes, that is number three. 85% like carrots. Jane.
Peas,
yes, 80%. That's five out of the top 10. Flick.
Cabbage.
No cabbage. No cabbage in the top 10.
That's really weird.
Yeah, no.
Tomatoes,
yeah, they are. And I know people will text in and say they're actually a fruit. 79% of people like tomatoes. Flick.
Yeah, well, avocados are a fruit too.
Still no avocado. I don't know what you're eating down there, Flip, but it's not. You're not resonating. You're out of touch when it comes to the nation's vegetables. Jane, have another go.
French beans.
No French beans. Flick?
Do we count onions then?
Onions, yes. Number four, onions. Well done. You're on the scoreboard. Jane?
Garlic?
Garlic, no garlic. Oh, I've just realised that we haven't really thought through the format of this. We could be here for hours. Flick?
Oh, I'm running out of things. I brought beans.
No. Jane?
artichokes.
Sweet potatoes.
What did you say again?
Sweet potatoes.
Not sweet potatoes, no.
Are we missing? How many are we missing from the top 10?
One, two, three, four. You've only got five so far.
Oh, my God.
Some of them are subcategories of things we've had.
Right. Sugar snaps.
No,
too.
This is not. I think we should call it a day on that. Is that what
runner beans?
No, runner beans. No. The whole nation is shouting vegetables at the radio, and they don't really know why. Right. I think are we going to call? Is that are we calling it at the end? Right. So, I'll take you through the top 10. In at 10, spring onions with 77%.
Ridiculous.
9, red peppers, tied with cherry tomatoes on 78%. Actual tomatoes on 79% in at 7. At 6, red onions with 80%. The same as peas with 80%. Onions, 81% at 4. Carrots at 3 with 85% of people liking carrots. New potatoes at 2, 86%. And then potatoes at 1.
That's a trick question.
So after that, just totting up, won't take long. Jane got 3 and Flick got 2.
Yeah,
that feels like this feels like a format that could run.
are these Times readers though?
No, this is you. No, this is Britain. This is YouGov polling of all of Britain.
Okay.
We failed. Well, I look forward to this. But this will be picked up by a major TV company in no time at all. Alan Carr will be presenting this on a Saturday night. Britain's top 10 favourite vegetables. Flick, lovely to speak to you. Flick Drummond, Tory MP for Meon Valley, and Jane Merrick, policy editor of the iPaper, and both keen allotmenteers. And that's all we've got time for on today's episode. Don't forget, Tuesdays, we bring you How to Win an Election. Just search for How to Win an Election wherever you're listening to this. It's Peter Mandelson, Danny Finkelstein, and Polly McKenzie guiding you through the highs and lows of the politics of fighting an election campaign. That's every Tuesday. Just search wherever you are listening to this. But for now, from me, Matt Chodley's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com